Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? I'm Kat, founder of Ritual. We're making traceability the new standard for the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I couldn't find a multivitamin I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested, and clean label project certified. Oh, and our vitamin D3? It comes from sustainably harvested lichen from England, not sheep. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome back, everybody. Time again for Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show, but today a sports conversation. John Suntress here. My buddy Bill Detloff from Ringside Seat, the editor-in-chief and a fine author. We've talked to him before about some of his biographies in the past, like his excellent biography on the 50s heavyweight champion Ezzard Charles, the man that came between Joe Louis and Rocky Marciano. Today we talk about his brand new book about light heavyweight champion Matthew Saad Muhammad. An amazing story, a gutsy all-action fighter who would come back from being behind and taking 20 shots and then all of a sudden rising with a rally and stopping and beating guys. An incredible fighter in a very competitive era of 175-pound fighters. So many great contenders and champions within that era, and Matthew saw most of them. It's a very interesting story. We also just talk about boxing in general, where things are these days. We also preview the upcoming issue of Ringside Seat. We're talking to Bill Detloff today about boxing on today's Word Balloon. This episode of Word Balloon is brought to you by Pulse College. Pulse College has 3 decades of a proven track record delivering professional industry training courses in audio, music, film, games, and animation. Since 1991, Pulse has received international recognition for both its vocational and practical-driven academic courses. All courses are designed and delivered by experienced industry professionals and offer cutting-edge blends of academic perspectives fused with practical skill sets in the areas of film, music, games, and animation. This, combined with the unique teaching and learning environment of the iconic Windmill Lane Recording Studios, makes world-class industry education attainable. Learners from around the world can join in a variety of short courses offered remotely via Zoom in the fields of sequential art and design, 2D animation, 3D animation, character design, and game environments. For more details, visit PulseCollege.com. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Word Balloon. This is John Suntress with an important plea for 2023. You probably read the headlines. Word Balloon took a sponsorship hit that was pretty significant, and I'm asking you if you've ever been a fan of Word Balloon and considered making a donation through Patreon. A very meager but important subscription. I hope you'll consider it. It's going to be a challenging 2023, and I need your help. So if you like Word Balloon, if you enjoy the content, I'm not going to slow down and keep bringing you some excellent content, but I could really use your help via Patreon, patreon.com/wordballoon. If you can afford the price of a comic book, if you can even afford $1 a month, it would be greatly appreciated and help the cause to keep Word Balloon going at the level and intensity that I've been doing in the last 4 or 5 years and bring you a lot more content and a lot of great interviews and interesting things about the pop culture world. Patreon.com/wordballoon. I could really use your help. Thank you for your attention, your time, and listening to Word Balloon. Word Balloon is brought to you by AlexRossArt.com. Alex has been a longtime sponsor of Word Balloon. I greatly appreciate it. You got to go to his website. You will find tremendous art from original work, covers, pages, fantastic lithographs, amazing posters. Every price point is covered and every subject is covered at AlexRossArt.com. You've enjoyed his iconic looks at DC and Marvel, but also great stuff like his wonderful work on the Monkees, Monty Python, so many other great pop culture things that Alex has put his fingerprints on. His wonderful Flash Gordon poster that evokes the fantastic Dino De Laurentiis Sam Jones movie. Recently, Alex did things like the timeless Marvel covers featuring great solo shots of all your favorite Marvel heroes, and of course his Fantastic Four full circle graphic novel still available. All waiting for you now at alexrossart.com. Welcome back, everybody. Time again for Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show, a special edition of the Big Bout podcast. John Suntress here. Really happy to welcome back from ringside seat author William Dedloff. Bill, good to see you, man.
It's good to see you, John. Thanks very much for having me on. I appreciate it very much.
My pleasure, man. I'm always happy to talk to you. I know we did a solo talk about your fine book, Boxing Life, the Ezra Charles biography you did.
Yes, we did.
And now we jump a couple decades ahead to kind of the golden age of light heavyweights.
Absolutely.
With a look at Matthew Saad Muhammad, Boxing's Miracle Man from McFarlane Books. Matt Franklin, man, great. First of all, great cover. And, man,
if we speak about the cover, we have to say that it's the cover was by designed by Michael Cronenberg, who, of course, was the founder and designer at Ringside Seat Magazine, our mutual friend. So we can't let an opportunity to go by, or I can't let an opportunity to go by without acknowledging Michael's great design work. Again, look at that cover. It's gorgeous.
Absolutely,
He did a great job on the cover, as he does with every cover of Ringside Seat Magazine.
I told you before we started, I wanted to acknowledge him with this fantastic cover. Yeah, really, Michael. Michael is amazing. Michael and his son do a fantastic podcast as well, and I know you're going to be on there shortly. Michael recovering from COVID. Feel better, Michael, if you're watching or listening. You know, the career of Matthew Saad Muhammad, formerly Matt Franklin, heartbreaking, kind of a classic boxer's tale from rags to riches, back to rags, unfortunately.
Yep.
What intrigued you about this story?
Well, a couple things. First, as you, we were just discussing how close in age we are to one another. And so you were probably around the same, of course, around the same age I was in the early 80s when Matthew Saad Muhammad, or Matt Franklin at the time, was engaging in all those wars on ABC and CBS, free television on a Saturday afternoon with Marvin Johnson and Richie Cates and all those title defenses he made, John Conte, of course, a couple times. And so what intrigued me right off the bat, of course, was he was unforgettable as an action fighter. In a decade full, in an era full of great action fighters, there were so many good action fighters, and we saw them all the time, which I really think is a difference between now and then, by the way. There are lots of very good action fighters now. We just don't get to see them.
100%, man. No, you're right. It really did make a difference being on free TV.
Absolutely.
Kind of
all that exposure. Those guys were able to build fan bases that followed them from earlier in their careers up to their championship days. Yep.
And Matthew fought like the cream of the crop of his era. And it was truly, much like we talk about the 70s with heavyweights.
Right.
That late 70s, mid 80s through Michael Spinks's career, you know, or title reign. I mean, these were amazing 175-pound light heavyweight champions and contenders.
Exactly right. I don't think I would get much opposition to say to anybody who knows boxing that was the deepest light heavyweight division in any era that you'd care to discuss or compare it to. I think what comes in second probably is the light heavyweight era that Ezra Charles dominated and fought in. Right, him and Archie Moore and Harold Johnson and all those guys who were around at that time. But certainly the late 70s to mid 80s light heavyweights, nothing like him. Matthew Saad Muhammad, Marvin Johnson, Eddie Mustafa Muhammad, Yaki Lopez, Richie Cates, James Scott, Dwight Muhammad Cowie, Michael Spinks, it went on and on. Eddie Davis, all very good fighters. And it's not an insult to today's fighters to say a lot of those guys would be world champions today, because I would say that a lot of them would be world champions even in prior eras, right? A guy like Marvin Johnson, well, he was a world champion, of course, but he would have been a dominant champion in the 50s and 60s, certainly, or maybe the 40s. And same with Eddie Mustafa Muhammad, Eddie Gregory at the time, or for part of the time, and Michael Spinks, of course, and Dwight Braxton. These were really great fighters who would have competed competed and done very well in any light heavyweight era you can care to name, in my view.
Out of the box, Mike Jones chiming in and saying John Conte was from his hometown. The first Muhammad versus John fight is the stuff of legends around these parts. Absolutely, man. Yeah. And John is a great example. Mate Parlov, who Matthew also fought. And, you know, you mentioned Dwight Braxton, Dwight Muhammad Kawi. These are great fights. I got a chance to interview Kawi before he fought Foreman.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. Which
that was really interesting.
Yeah. Well, and also, I mean, I loved him as light heavy, but those wars, really the first fight more so, that he gave a cruiserweight to Holyfield.
Sure. You know? Oh, great. Fantastic fight.
Yeah, man. No. And, you know, you got to love a 5'9" fire plug of a guy like Kawi with short arms and stuff. And just got much like, well, the physical opposite of Saad Muhammad, but, you know, would just get in the thick of things in all action. And Saad, is it fair to say for Saad, you know, kind of a tall and rangy light heavy?
He was a tall, rangy guy with long arms and, you know, and a good reach and all that.
Yeah.
But he didn't really fight like a tall guy, right? He just, well, there's two different versions, right? There's the early version, the pre-Eddie Mustafa Muhammad version, where he was kind of a boxer puncher and a punch and clutch kind of guy. And then he had the kind of an epiphany following his close decision loss to Eddie Gregory at the time, where he said, if I'm not going to get these close decisions, I'm just not going to be a boxer anymore. I'm just going to punch. Yeah. And that is when he was born as the most exciting fighter of his era. Again, in an era full of really exciting fighters we got to see all the time. Like, think of a guy like Ray Mancini, how exciting Ray Boom Boom Mancini was, or Alexis Arguello, or Roberto Duran, and Sugar Ray Leonard, and Thomas Hearns, all really exciting fighters. But nothing, they all kind of, they all had, none of them were, I should say it this way, Matthew Saad Muhammad was better than none of them, right, except maybe for Mancini, but he was more exciting than all of them.
Yeah.
He had an amazing ability to look like he was on his way out, clearly on his way out, about to lose violently and come back. And he did it over and over and over again. Much like the younger fans today revere Arturo Gatti. And I don't like to draw that corollary if I don't have to, but it is a good one. Because Matthew Saad Muhammad was a full level better than Arturo Gatti. Matthew Saad Muhammad was a real world-class fighter.
Right? Bill, I am so with you. And I really do respect Gatti.
Yeah, sure.
He was a great slugger. But that said, there were literally like three or four welterweights that were better than him. Am I weight class correct with Gatti? Was he welterweight?
Well, he fought from junior lightweight up until up to welterweight. But yeah,
okay.
You know, I love Gatti too, but he lost to Ivan Robinson and Angel Manfredi and De La Hoya and Mayweather. And there's no shame in losing to these guys.
No.
But Matthew Saad Muhammad was beating the best light heavyweights in the world when light heavyweight was the best division in the sport and the best light heavyweight era ever. So,
Yeah, man. And also, I mean, God, that streak that he had after kind of not a shaky beginning, but, you know, this is an era when it wasn't a disgrace to lose.
Absolutely right. He lost an early fight to Wayne McGee, who was really a nobody and never really turned into anybody. He didn't have a successful pro career, really. And he drew with the same guy later. And he lost an early fight, another early fight. So he wasn't one of these undefeated superstars on the rise. No Olympic gold medal or any of that stuff. He, you know, he worked his way up like a lot of guys from that era did and from that region, you know, in Philadelphia, where they took a lot of hard fights, you know. And so anyway, he was the most exciting fighter in an era full of very exciting fighters. So that was the attraction initially to writing the book, just having all these great memories of him. But also, anybody who's read the book or will read the book, you'll find that his personal story is tragic and fascinating and compelling and is unlike any you'll read anywhere else or that you'll hear anywhere else about just about any other fighter. And to put it in a nutshell, I know you know this, John, but I'll say for the benefit of your listeners and your viewers, he was abandoned on the streets of Philadelphia, was found on the Ben Franklin Parkway, at the age of four, with no parents or anybody around. He was taken to the police, And the police put an ad in the paper the next day with his picture and said, child found on the parkway. And they were hoping that somebody would claim him, of course. Nobody did. And so he was turned over to the Catholic nuns who had a parish in the area and put in an orphanage for a while and then went to foster homes. And then was adopted by the Santos family in South Philly. Then began a long career in juvenile delinquency, to put it mildly. But he's got an amazing personal story, excuse me, that you can perceive relative to his boxing career one of two ways. Either he overcame all those things to become a great boxer and a very memorable one, or those things contributed to him being a great and memorable boxer. I'm in the latter crowd, by the way. I think that all those things, his upbringing and his being abandoned and him having grown up in the area which he grew up in, which was very rough and led to him being involved in a lot of street gangs and crime, kind of contributed to making him the fighter that he turned out to be.
Agreed. Also, I think you provide a really great background of the Philadelphia boxing scene.
Thanks.
Beyond the obvious, beyond the Joe Frazier story.
Yep.
And you really get into where the people that helped him with his career, both training but also managing and stuff, where they came from and how they were connected to Philly boxing and stuff. And it's a real education to deepen your knowledge. New York always, you know, everybody knows about the Garden and Gleason's Gym, right, and a lot of the great trainers of from really, you know, the 20s all the way through the 60s and 70s.
Sure.
But it's great to read again about beyond Joe Frazier and Yank Durham and
right,
Eddie Futch and
right,
the guys like that helped Frazier out and stuff. And that's the thing. I mean, Saad's really got this amazing career that is so deeply tied to Philly. I mean, him and Jeff Chandler, I think, are really the next two guys after Frazier when you think of Philly fighters.
Absolutely right. There should be. And along with that, people forget that both of those guys were trained by Nick Belfiore from the time they came in off the streets. And Nick Belfiore gets no credit from anyone ever. You never hear his name mentioned. The guy trained two Hall of Famers from his little Juniper Street gym from the time they walked the streets to world champions. And both those fighters dumped him, by the way, and got other people in charge of them. So he didn't capitalize as much as one would have liked to see him. But nobody ever talks about what a great trainer Nick Belfiore was. And we can debate about how much a great fighter is made by the trainer, right? Whether the trainer makes the fighter or vice versa. But it's not a coincidence when you got two guys, two Hall of Famers coming out of your little tiny gym in South Philly and within 10 years of each other. That's not a coincidence. Those things don't happen to many trainers. You know, guys trained, there are trainers out there who've been working with kids for 60 years and they're still waiting for their champion to walk through the door. And Nick Belfiore had a couple of them within 10 years of each other, 5 years of each other, really. And it was really a lot of fun, frankly, researching all that was going on in Philadelphia from a boxing perspective in that period. Because every time there's a fighter from Philadelphia who's doing well or who's got a fight coming up, like Danny Garcia, for example, writers, especially general sports writers, let me put it that way, will mention, like you did, like the most famous names from Philadelphia, and they'll mention a name or two. But the number of fight gyms that were around in the 60s and 70s, late 70s, or into the 80s in Philadelphia was just ridiculous. You could throw a rock. You could stand in any part of Philadelphia and throw a rock in any direction and hit a fight gym that was just full of kids who wanted to be champions, who wanted to be fighters. And that's why that area, that city really produced so many really great and memorable fighters. And the gym wars, of course, are legend. But really, there were so many fight gyms around and so many fight clubs. There were fights all the time. Say what you will about the effect that boxing has on a person's cognitive well-being, if you like. You can have that debate.
Sure, sure.
But, man, in those situations and in that environment, I got to think that boxing saved a hell of a lot more lives than it hurt, because there were just so many kids that needed something, right? So many kids that had nothing and needed something. And they didn't have to turn out to be champions in order to be saved by boxing. Matthew Saad Muhammad happened to be one who was saved by boxing and also who became a champion. But wow, what a service all those trainers and all those gyms did for all those kids in Philadelphia in those days who needed it, who needed something, right?
Absolutely, man. A few other Philly fighters like, you know, Betty Briscoe and
absolutely.
Was it Gypsy Joe Harris?
Gypsy Joe Harris and
yeah.
And you know, and Georgie Benton,
of course.
Earl Hargrove a little later in the '80s, and Frank Fletcher and Curtis Parker and Dwight Davis and all those guys. Who were all a little later than the period we're talking about, really. But so many good fighters, so many skilled fighters and great trainers in that area during that period.
Absolutely. You know, I always keep forgetting to ask our mutual friend Nigel Collins if he was based in Philly.
He was.
So he must have been an invaluable source as well for you. I know you did your research and really, you know, combed through stuff. And also being a fan yourself, had your own memories of watching Matt Franklin in action and everything. But yeah, you know.
Yeah, Nigel was friends with Matt. And he gave me the best quote, I believe the best quote in the book, when he was talking about the first Matt Franklin Marvin Johnson fight, and he said it was the only fight I ever covered where I thought both guys might die. And if you watch that fight, man, you can't blame them. You can't blame them because they were just hammering each other. It's interesting now. You know, time clouds things and it clouds details, and you forget certain things about, especially when you're a kid, right?
Absolutely.
And you know, I think if you're our age, okay. John, you're in your mid to late 50s.
Oh, yeah.
And you think back to Marvin Johnson. You say, oh, that guy was kind of funny looking. He had the really bad receding hairline. He made him look decades older than he was. And he got knocked out by Matt. He got knocked out by Eddie Gregory and blah, blah. But then you rewatch his fight against Matthew, both of them. And, man, Eddie Gregory was a 100% badass. Oh, not Eddie Gregory, but him too. Wow. But Marvin Johnson was 100% badass. The shots that he was hitting Matthew Saad Muhammad with at that time in both of their fights would have knocked out 99.9% of the human population. Marvin Johnson was a beast. And the only thing that saved Matthew Saad Muhammad against him was his ability and his toughness and his refusal to submit to or to cave in underneath the whirlwind that was Marvin Johnson, that had beaten everybody else but one guy up until that point in his pro career. Marvin Johnson was 100% badass, and Matt just out-toughed him and outmanned him twice. And again, the first fight, it's a perfect description when Nigel says the first fight I ever, or the only fight I've ever seen where I thought both guys might die. It sounds over the top, but it really isn't. If you watch that fight, and I encourage all your viewers and your listeners to go to YouTube and Absolutely. Watch the first Matthew Saad Muhammad, Marvin Johnson fight, and you'll be stunned. My favorite fight on YouTube of Matthew's, and thankfully almost all of his major fights are on YouTube, is his fight with Richie Cates, where I think Matt was at his absolute best as a boxer puncher. But they're all great. All of them are sensational fights.
Totally, man. No, you know, Yaki Lopez, another guy that on a different night would have been champion and everything.
Absolutely.
And, you know, and a wonderful fighter. Jerry Martin, a very solid light heavy contender and stuff. And that's the thing, man. These are all notches on Matt's belt. And, you know, Ali is really obviously best known for the rope-a-dope and taking punishment, coming from behind in the Foreman fight. But really, I mean, Matt did it more with a lot more action rather than just leaning on the ropes and everything and letting the other fighter punch himself out.
Yeah. I guess you could say that Matt had that one, like, 70-second period against Lopez in their second fight where he just took a pounding. And really, that happened in the first fight, too. We forget. He outboxed Lopez in the first fight. But there was one period where Lopez landed a right hand that hurt Matt, and Matt went against the ropes, and he unloaded. And it happened again in the second fight where Matt just stood there and took it. But, Ali was, against Foreman, and his rope-a-dope tactics later in his career were an entirely different thing than what Matt was doing. Matt was taking flush shots, where Ali was tying guys up, slipping and sliding, using the ropes to his advantage, pushing down on guys. That Matt was just taking flush shots to the head, partially because he was stunned and also because he knew he could. He knew at some point Yaki Lopez was going to empty his gun, and then Matt could take over. And he knew that there was nothing Lopez could do to him that he hadn't done to him in the first fight. So he had no real fear of Yaki Lopez. even though in their second fight, another one of my favorite passages from the book is when Matthew's best friend and sparring partner, Tony Green, told me he stayed with Matthew for a week after the second Yaki Lopez fight because Matt was so beat up. And he said, you know, Matt won that fight, but Lopez really hurt him. He really beat Matt up. And so he felt compelled to stay with Matt for a week after that fight to make sure he was okay.
You know, unfortunately, am I right? The diagnosis for Matt, as far as his passing, he died at 59, sadly.
Yeah.
And really had a rough third act of his life.
He did.
As depicted in the book. Did you ever have a chance to meet him?
I didn't. I never met him in person. I spoke to him on the phone a couple times.
Okay.
Which I talk about in the introduction to the book. And I'm glad that, John, that you brought up his reason, his cause of death. The doctors never gave a specific cause of death. But they did say that he had there was some evidence that he had ALS, right?
Yeah.
Which is very strange because nobody that I spoke with told me that they ever saw any evidence of any ALS. And we know by now the symptoms of ALS, paralysis, right? Difficulty walking,
yes,
slurred speech. And he didn't really have those things. There were times when he didn't respond as quickly as we might hope, but a lot of people are like that, right? The guys in their 50s, I'm like that. I don't respond as quickly as I like.
Right? That'll take You're singing my song, man. I'm with you. I know.
So I don't deny that there was probably some cognitive damage there. How could there not be?
Yeah.
Right? But to be honest with you, I'm not convinced that that we have the full story with regard to what caused his death. And I'm sorry, go ahead.
No. You finish your thought, please.
It could be that the doctors don't know exactly. And that happens sometimes.
Yeah.
People don't realize that it's not a concrete reason you get every single time somebody dies. It doesn't always work that way. So I think there might be a couple of things going on. Either the doctors weren't entirely sure, and I think that's a very possible, the most likely answer. Or there is something that maybe somebody didn't want released that was going on too. There was a hospitalization in the year prior, the year before he died, that one friend of Matt's told me he didn't want to talk about. Not the friend, but Matt. He asked Matt about it. Matt wouldn't talk to him about it. So he was hospitalized the year before he died and wouldn't tell anybody why.
Wow.
So that tells me there was something going on that maybe there was some other contributing factor. I'll put it that way. Okay. Yeah. So you brought up cause of death. So I still have some questions and I wish that I would have been able to explore them more deeply in the book, but like I write at the end, dead is dead. It doesn't really matter. In the end, all that matters is number one, that he's dead. And number two, that he left this really amazing legacy that results in him, or results, I should say, in us talking about him so many years later, after his career is ended from as a boxing superstar in the 1980s. And we're talking about him today, right? Because as you know, as well as anybody, there aren't many guys whose legacies stretch that far.
Absolutely not. God, and especially, you know, his prime really started in that very late 70s period as well. And also, I found it interesting. I didn't know until I read your stuff that he even like flirted with MMA in the early 90s.
Yeah,
as many boxers did.
Right, exactly. He had one MMA fight in Japan and failed miserably because it didn't compute with him that this guy was going to be jumping on his back and wrestling him. Right, he was ready to punch. This went terribly. And that was the first and last time he did that. Then he had one more pro boxing match after that, and that was it. So he was just trying to make a buck at that stage in his life, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I remember reading in publications like one that I wrote for, Boxing Illustrated, where, you know, you'd get these Matthew Saad Muhammad sightings,
right?
And it's like, well, first of all, the guy is still in ridiculous shape.
Yeah, he physically looked good, right?
Yeah, which another thing, if he had ALS or whatever other condition and stuff. No, he didn't. Like you said, and even cognitively, it seemed for the most part that he was okay. But man, just, you know, terrible things about him being homeless at the end too, but also advocating for the homeless, which is pretty amazing. I mean,
he got a lot of he got a lot of credit for that, for you know, joining a group that advocated for the homeless, like you said, and I suppose that he should have. I'm not sure if that would have been important to him or as important to him if he weren't homeless. You know what I'm saying? You know, and I don't mean to be crass or to take credit away from him, but he was just doing whatever he could at that time to get by and trying to get back on his feet, which he did for a while. But the only thing that he could do, as is the case with many, many fighters who were retired, the only thing he knew was boxing, so all he could do was train guys, right? And it's a rough way to make a living.
Yeah, talk about him as a trainer. How did he do?
Not great. Like, you can't name a – well, I shouldn't say that. He made a difference in the lives of several young boxers, okay, which is the most important thing. But in terms of making a living from it or being financially successful, no. You can't name one guy that he trained, right?
Yeah.
You ever see him in the corner of a TV fighter, a guy fighting on TV?
No. Well, and like you said, too, oh, I'm sorry, again, I'm sorry, I keep stepping.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
I was going to say, like, you know, guys like Ted Williams that became managers in baseball and stuff, they couldn't impart what they know to that next generation. And I would say the same thing about Matt.
Might have been. Yeah. I could imagine him coaching a fighter who's been stunned, who wants to quit or something, or goes down saying, "What are you, crazy? I took 40 punches in a row on the ropes against Yankee Lopez, and you're going to go down from that body shot?" You know, could you imagine him? Could you imagine him training Ryan Garcia?
Recent memory of people quitting. Right. Absolutely, right. Man. Right. Tank Davis, definitely, man. Jesus. We'll talk about some recent fights in a minute, I hear you, man. No, it's as you said, I imagine, and especially given what you do with Ringside Seat as well, during COVID, when really sports just shut down initially, and even before we got boxing in the bubbles, mm-hmm. like we did after a few months and stuff, I was all over YouTube watching Matthew Saad Muhammad, Eddie Mustafa Muhammad, and all those great, like you said, late 70s, early 80s fights that were on Saturdays and Sundays on the major networks. And thank God they're all there on YouTube, man, for the most part. It's pretty great.
It is pretty great. We didn't know then how lucky we were, right? Of course, because nobody ever does in the moment, right? But we are so lucky now that they're on YouTube. Who would have imagined when we were kids that 30 or 40 years later, we could go on a computer and click a button and watch that whole fight again? I was a George Foreman fanatic as a kid. He was my hero. Okay.
Sure.
And I remember watching his fights on television and thinking, wouldn't it be incredible if I had those tapes? And this was, I'm an early teenager by the time I'm thinking this way. And then we got to the age with VHS tapes, and you could go through guys' lists and say, oh, they have this and that. And then we could rent fight tapes and that kind of thing. And now we're at the stage where I can watch any George Foreman fight from my childhood that I want in a matter of seconds. That is amazing. That is absolutely amazing. And what a gift to fight fans.
Where did you grow up, Bill?
I grew up in New Jersey, in New Jersey, central New Jersey.
So that's fight country and everything.
Oh, sure. Yeah,
I'm sure you knew a guy that might have been tied to the pros or the amateurs. I can't remember this guy's name in Chicago, but we would go to he would rent out a ballroom and just have his old fight films with him that he had collected over the years.
A New Jersey guy?
This is a Chicago guy was doing that.
Okay.
But again, no, I mean, we would, you know, I mean, oh man, I got, and the best was like, oh, I've got a newsreel clip of Charlie Burnley, like sparring, you know, something like, and we're like, oh, we all want to see it, man. That's all we got.
When I was about probably 14 and I was fighting as an amateur and my trainer gave me a projector, not the projector, but he gave me the 8mm film of Ollie Frazier 1. And I sat in my parents' house in the little dining room at night with the lights off, watching an 8mm film of Ollie Frazier 1. Just blown away, of course, what I'm watching. And today, click, I can watch it anytime I want. Stop it here, stop it there, go get a drink, come back, watch the rest of it. We live, for all we complain now, we live in an amazing age in that respect.
Yeah, for those kinds of things, absolutely, man. No, it's wonderful. And also, not only the fights themselves, but, you know, God, it's so funny. I forget it, a few months ago or weeks ago, they were acknowledging that, you know, it had been so many years since HBO stopped doing boxing coverage.
Right.
And you think of some of the controversial fights like Tyson Douglas, and not only their coverage of the fight itself, but the aftermath and having the balls to have Don King and Mike on ragging about the Douglas fight. And, you know, they, Douglas should have been knocked out the long counts and everything that they claimed were happening during Douglas Tyson. I mean, it's amazing, and that they had the clout to stand up to a promoter like Don King and go, "Don will give you a chance to talk, but we disagree."
Think of
today's boxing product that you have to cover every month and everything, and the way that the promoters really run every, and it's not just boxing, it's happening in all the major sports where the leagues are really kind of controlling the television in a lot of ways.
Sure. And they control the narrative. That's precisely why. And to a degree, it's been like that always, to some degree, right? Everybody wants to control the message, right? Used to happen by managers paying off newspaper writers, right? Like in the 40s, when there was no television and no film, the newspaper writers would just, the managers would go around at ringside, get this guy at 20, they've got guy at 20, so that the newspaper writers in their columns the next day would write favorably about that manager's fighter, right? So it's always been that way. It's always been about controlling the message. So, my philosophy, not only as a fan, but as the editor-in-chief of Ringside Seat magazine, is to concentrate on the fights themselves, and the stories, even more so than the fights, the stories that the fighters bring into the ring with them, and the stories of the fights. We have so many great writers working for us, and writing for us, I should say, that are great at telling the stories of these fighters. Right, so that's what I try to concentrate on in our magazine. And I hate to write about boxing politics. I don't want to know from negotiations. I don't want to know pay-per-view buy rates. I'm not even interested in purses or contracts. None of that bullshit. I want to know about what happens in the ring between the first bell and the last. And I want to know about the stories that the fighters bring into the ring with them. And that's what I think our magazine concentrates on mostly.
Absolutely, man. No, it truly. And listen, I still like Ring. I still like Boxing Monthly from the UK. There are a lot of great boxing publications out there.
Sure, absolutely.
But you guys, you know, I know you guys came from Ring, a good number of you. And and again, no, I really appreciate Ringside Seat whenever a new issue is out. We can, when we wrap up, we can talk about some of the stuff that you're quoting in the latest issue. Sure. Got to ask, given everything you just said, I am in a, unfortunately, like taking your dog and sticking him in the, his nose in the business. We're going to have to get in the dirty side. So what did you think of Haney versus Lomachenko and the fight itself? Your observations of what happened.
I think the result was consistent with boxing's history of judges favoring a younger, fresher guy with a bigger upside, with the bigger eventual upside. And that's just that's as old as the sport itself.
Yeah, absolutely, man.
I don't disagree with the consensus that Loma did enough to get it, did enough to win it. And I wholeheartedly agree with the opinion that Moretti's scorecard was an abomination and he should just stop judging fights, but he won't. They run these guys to death, man. These guys will be on respirators judging fights. I just don't get it. Well, I do get it. It's not about the fight. It's about the money and the old boys club or whatever. So I won't get into whether I don't really know if I would describe it as a robbery. I just know that it's consistent with what boxing has always done when a young, charismatic guy like Haney with a big upside meets an older guy who's kind of had his run at the top already, which is crazy when you consider Loma's had so few fights, right?
Well, so few professional fights, but you're
right. Exactly.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
No, you're right.
Yeah. But to consider him already, he's old news. Haney's got so much more upside. So, and that's the consensus, I think, among the boxing hierarchy. And so that's so the decision didn't surprise me. And we all know, we can see this going in time and again. And Raleigh's recent fight with that guy, Basoro, I might be mispronouncing his name, who looked like he was 107 years old, but he was winning the fight, right? And you just knew as the fight was progressing, there's no way they're going to rob him on the cards, or it's going to end some way, and it did. And Tony Weeks, of all people, who I think we've come to trust more than a lot of guys, stopped it almost inexplicably. There's a small piece of me that says, you know what? Tony Weeks saw this guy was going to get hit hard soon, and he was just saving that from him. But, you know, saving him from that. And I kind of get that. And I kind of want to commend Tony Weeks for his humanitarian approach in that moment, right? But Tony, that's not your job. It's not your job to be the nice guy. That's just not what it is. His job is to let the fight conclude out of its own volition. And nobody forced him into the ring. Nobody put him a gun to his head and said, you got to fight Raleigh. The guy was doing his job. He was leading on the scorecards. And if Raleigh was going to take the fight at that point by giving him a concussion, that's the sport.
Yes.
That's the sport.
I'm with you, man. No, I feel the same way. You know, it's funny. I was rewatching the Legendary Knights presentation of the Chavez-Meldrick Taylor
fight. Yep.
And in the same way, you know, all those different circumstances.
Sure.
But kind of in the same way with Tony Weeks, Richard Steele had reached that level of like the Walter Cronkite of boxing referees. You trust right. Richard Steele.
Yeah. Sure, sure.
And, you know, I think in the same way that initially when he stopped it, we're all like, what the hell? And then we got the medical report immediately after the fight and how banged up Taylor was. And it's like, you know, I kind of now do sympathize with Steele 30 years later where I'm like, I kind of get it, what he was doing. But, man, just 2 seconds left. 2 seconds left in that fight.
Yeah,
that's another great one for everyone to watch if they haven't seen it before.
When I was writing for Ring and KO, I think it was KO, we named that the fight of the decade. Brilliant, brilliant boxing match. And in a way, a great street fight also.
Oh,
and the stoppage still bothers me more than it should because Chavez wouldn't have landed another punch.
100%. Right. Yeah, man. So, no, and again, especially the way they presented in Legendary Knights, God, you just see Meldrick Taylor just slashing with these amazing 4 and 5 punch combinations. Yeah. And just, you know, but then all of a sudden with 30 seconds to go, Chavez catches him and is unstoppable. Well, as you know, too, it was, and I don't remember the sequence, but that year we had that fight. we had the Geezers at Caesars with Foreman and Cooney, which is only two rounds, but a shit ton of fun.
Yeah.
And then we had Tokyo and Douglas Tyson.
Wow, that's right. You know, you're absolutely right. You know what? The Chavez Taylor fight was on the day that I got married.
Oh my God.
We left the reception and I wanted very badly to have a TV somewhere in there, but you know, that wasn't happening, right? But all my friends, we all wanted to go see the fight. We wanted to know what the outcome was. So we got in our cars and other limos after the reception, put on the radio. And this is something that has changed. We put on the radio and within minutes they had announced the result of the fight. And it wasn't like a sports station. It was a regular radio station on FM.
Sure. Yeah.
It wasn't like FAN or any of that. But
I'm with you.
But yeah, but that still bugs me. And speaking of the Legendary Nights, HBO's Legendary Nights presentation of that examination of that fight, they really do Lou Duva dirty, but he deserved it. Because if you remember, and I just like talking about this because it's funny to me, they interview Duva and they say, what did you tell Taylor between the 11th and 12th rounds? And Duva says, I told him, box, 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 move, move, move.
Stay away from
him. And then they show the clip of what he told him between 11th. And he said, fight him, back him up, knock him out. You got to knock him out. So they did Duva dirty, but he deserved it. And
proof is there.
Exactly right. And it was Duva at whom Taylor was looking when Steele was asking him questions, because Duva had climbed up on the ring apron and he had distracted Taylor from Steele.
Yes.
If he had kept his fat ass ringside straight down, perhaps Taylor would have been able to
compose himself.
Steele.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And
the fight might have continued.
No, you're right, man. No, you're absolutely right. And even poor Georgie Benton, who I love and always loved in the corner when he was with a Duva fighter.
Sure.
You know, he's doing it too. We need this round. We need this round. Yeah, man.
No,
yikes.
Oh. No,
and I didn't even realize because I saw, I'm trying to remember now if it was, I was at Chavez Taylor too. And really? Also one of the Chavez Frankie Randall fights where Taylor fought on the undercard leading up to that rematch. Okay. And poor Meldrick, man. I mean, it's I kind of like Matthew Saad Muhammad, where it's this really tragic, even more so, of slurred speech and just a shadow of his former self. And it's, God, and then you go back prior to that Chavez fight, the amount of promise. I mean, he did beat Aaron Davis afterwards to win a full welterweight title when he and Chavez fought at 140 and everything. But, yeah man.
Yeah, no, I see. Yeah, there's a lot of thought now that – because I remember writing about this, that I felt like the Chavez fight ruined Taylor, right? And I thought there was ample evidence of that at the time in the immediate following fights and the following years. But there's been some thought against that now because he beat Aaron, Aaron for a title and Glenwood Brown. But people are forgetting Glenwood Brown knocked him down twice, right? He didn't look great. He got knocked out by Terry Norris, knocked out by Crescento España. He was getting knocked out all over the place, knocked down or knocked out all the time after the Chavez fight. So I remember speaking with one guy about that fight, and he didn't think it was the case where the Chavez fight physically ruined Taylor. But more so that he trained his heart out for that fight, lost it anyway, and never found the motivation again to train as hard. Which is a different kind of ruination, right? It's still ruined him, but not in a physical way, like mentally ruined him.
I'm with you.
That's possible too, I think.
No, I hear you, man.
Yeah, and Aaron Davis, of course, was the name I was trying to think of before, but all I could get out was Aaron. So yeah, you were right.
I knew what you meant. We said Aaron Davis. It's cool. Don't worry, man. I'll be honest. I was gonna say, and maybe I'm getting it wrong, but because when we talk about guys like Lomachenko, who at 35 still showed that he has plenty in the tank and should be respected, was it Daniel Asparagosa or Daniel Mendoza, who was like a 130 pounder, who was like boxing Methuselah in the late 80s, early 90s, and kept winning and even won a title at an age where a featherweight should or whatever. Featherweight to 135, somewhere in there, the guy I'm thinking.
Daniel Zaragoza.
It is Zaragoza. Thank you, man.
Yeah. He lost the title to Eric Morales. Yeah.
And he would never get the benefit of the doubt today.
Right.
You're right about that. And that's why when I was thinking about that with Haney, because it's like, listen, Haney's a great fighter. He's got years ahead of him. To be honest, man, this is what kept me from fully believing in Canelo Alvarez when he first fought Triple G. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, Triple G beat him. At least in my opinion, I'm like, he beat him in that first fight.
Yeah.
And the second fight, I think, was a draw. And listen, Canelo has more than proven himself. And he had that amazing streak that ended with him fighting Bivol, I believe.
Yep. That's right.
I mean, my God. So listen, no disrespect to Canelo Alvarez.
It's not.
And also a guy that was willing to take a loss fighting, Floyd Mayweather so early in Alvarez's career. It's like, I got a lot of respect for him. But man, every now and then, and again, maybe as we get older and stuff, I'm more sympathetic to the older fighters, but I got to stop believing that they got a shot, because I think you're right. I think there is this almost mentality of the fighter with the upside is going to get the benefit of the doubt in a close fight.
Yeah, absolutely. The A side gets the benefit of the doubt. And
well, that's the other thing. You're absolutely right about that. Whose fighter is the promoter of the fight?
Right.
And it really is becoming a house fighter kind of situation, which is complete shit.
You're right, it is, but it's not new. It's not new, right? It's been that way forever.
Mike has another question for you. Saad's fights with Mate Parlov, was getting an out-of-town decision in Italy back then as hard as it was in later decades?
That's a good question. I don't think it's – I think it has always been difficult and will continue to be difficult for a fighter to win a decision in another fighter's country, right? It's just the way it is.
Yeah.
And it's just always been that way, and it will continue to be that way. And we can say that, England is the worst at rendering fair decisions involving hometown fighters. And the English will say, you can't win a fight in America if you're a Brit. Right, it's just the way it is. We all have this impression that if our fighters go to another country and fight, they're going to get robbed. And Roy Jones couldn't go to Germany to fight Mikulchevsky because he would get robbed like he did in the Olympics. And it's just the way it is. So that's just the way it's always been in boxing, and the way it will continue to be in boxing. And this is going to sound so odd, but that's kind of part of the fun. Like, you know that shit's going on, and you know it's going to happen. When you see who recently did I see? I can't remember now because I'm old. Somebody I was talking or writing recently about a fighter who went into another country and to another fighter's country and won a majority decision. Okay, so you know that means he beat the guy around the ring for 12 or 15 rounds. If he won a majority decision in that guy's home country, right? I can't think of who it is now.
Well, but,
that's the way it's always been.
Even Usyk, Anthony Joshua, their first fight. I believe that's how the judges were on that first fight.
Sure.
And Usyk was absolutely beating Anthony Joshua.
Sure.
And really, I kind of think the last round that the bell rang a little early and kind of saved Anthony from, if not going down, looking incredibly bad in the closing seconds of round 12 in that
that's
fight.
Possible. Was it a shortened round? I don't know. He was falling fast.
Yeah, man, he was on the ropes. You know, he's leaning on the ropes, and Usyk was pounding him. Oh, here, Mike's got a follow up. He says, "Agreed, the UK is bad, but even worse was Sven Hauke in Germany. That was unreal. I remember Robin Reed being saved." Mike knows
caution for punching. This can't be the Mike Jones from Philadelphia who used to be a fighter, right? I'm sure there's a million Mike Jones guys in the name of Mike Jones.
Well, I was thinking too, and I'm probably getting it wrong for a last name, but one of Jerry Cooney's managers.
Right.
Is that who you're talking about?
Yeah.
I know. I was thinking the same thing.
Yeah.
Probably not. That Mike Jones might have passed away. I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know. Right. I really don't know. But
yeah, he did. He did.
He did. Okay.
Right. He did. But I was thinking about the fighter from Philadelphia named Mike Jones who helped me with my book on Joe Frazier. He was the guy who he fought out of Philly for a while, a middleweight. He Simon Russell Peltz and had a couple of fights on HBO, and he was knocked out by the guy Randall Bailey. And that was pretty much the end of his career. But his name is Mike Jones. So, but I'm sure there are lots of Mike Joneses out there. So no offense to you, Mike. But you're absolutely right. It was tremendously hard to go into Germany and beat Sven Aki. And there's a guy who I can't risk. You know what? This is a very hard business. Boxing is a very hard business. And if you can get in and make a shit ton of money and get out without getting your brain scrambled, man, you got it made. But from a boxing perspective, I can't respect a guy like Aki who never ventured out of his home territory at all. Couldn't knock anybody out except for that, except for the guy from Australia, whose name escapes me, of course, at the moment. But never really took any chances against any very good fighters and was content to stay there in Germany and do his thing and retire pretty much unscathed. Good bully for him for doing it the right way. But that's not how you build a legacy and a great career. But if you don't care about that stuff, then rock and roll. Don't do your own thing.
Mike follows up and says, weirdly, I was nearly named after Teofilio Stevenson because his mother really loved the name. But his dad vetoed it, and that's why he's Mike Jones. Teofilio Jones. That would have been a fine name for you, man.
There you go.
That's fantastic. Oh, God. And that guy, man, what an amateur. Jesus Christ.
He was so dominant during that period.
Absolutely. And now, don't worry, Bill, because my brain is burping right now, and I'm not thinking of the name. The German guy, was it, that fought Tyson Fury and bloodied him and lost the decision? And he's an active
I know you're talking
German about. Or Swedish heavyweight.
It's terrible how I...
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, buddy, I'm sorry. I don't mean to...
You're killing me.
But no, there's
I know exactly who you're talking about.
Yeah,
is it Otto something? Otto...
It is Otto something, and maybe Mike knows. But, oh, man, yeah. It's truly, like, there's a guy that doesn't have the right juice behind him, and also nobody wants to fight him.
Yeah.
Because he busted up Tyson Fury, and yeah. Fury's really lucky that they allowed that fight to continue. Because any other promoter, any other fighter, they would have stopped that after. I mean, my God, he was
exactly right.
Ridiculous, the amount of blood that he lost and everything.
Right, and that gets back to being the A side. Right, if you weren't the A side, that fight would have been stopped. And in fact, if his opponent had been cut like that, the fight would have been stopped in that fight. Right.
How's Bob Arum in his 90s? Still, like, I mean, how much is he really running things, and how much are his kids running things? You know, I mean, I know his daughter's husband, and I forget who else. DeBuff. Yeah, exactly. No, I remember seeing DeBuff, the Bob's daughter, a lot in the 90s at various top rank cards and things like that, because I know she's very active in the organization, or was.
Yeah, as far as I know and can tell, Bob's still running the show. It's amazing. Good for him.
Hey, right? Absolutely. Like Norman Lear at 100 or whatever, and still able to make new TV shows. No, I'm absolutely with you. As we approach senior citizen era and stuff, it is great to see vital men in their senior years for decades beyond that.
Yeah, he's doing something right. He's doing something right.
Well, and Don, I know Don King is still there. Thank you, Mike. Otto Wallin. Absolutely. That's who we were talking about. Indeed.
Thank you.
I appreciate it, Mike. That's hilarious, man. A few other people watching, they're just not chiming in with comments the way Mike is. But yeah, as soon as I saw that fight, I'm like, we got to watch out for that guy. And everybody's avoiding Otto Wallin. Nobody wants to fight that guy. What are you going to do?
I don't know.
How about the Chinese guy that beat Joe Joyce?
He's interesting.
Very interesting.
He's not terrible for a great big giant guy. And. He's and you know what I mean by that, because a lot of these guys are just lumbering, you know. But there are a couple of heavyweights out there that can fight. Jared Anderson looks interesting if you want to talk about American heavyweights.
Sure.
And this big giant guy can fight a little bit. The guy who just won. So it could be interesting. I'd said before that I'd like to concentrate on the fights and what's happening in the ring. And so I tire fairly quickly of all the negotiations for Fury and Usyk. And now Fury's going to fight some guy nobody has ever heard of from Australia, I guess. And Wilder was going to fight Joshua, but now Joshua's talking about fighting Fury, and Wilder still hasn't signed with anybody. So, you know, it gets tiring. It gets tiring.
Man.
But you know what? And so, again, I concentrate on what happens in the ring and the stories they bring with them. And when I'm tempted to say, oh, this is just today's fight game, this is why nobody cares anymore because it sucks now. I think back to the 70s, for example, and say, you know, people were going crazy when George Foreman didn't defend his title for a year. And then when he finally did, he picked Joe Roman, right? And nobody believed Ali was anything anymore, and Frazier was supposedly finished. And it's all cyclical. It all happens over and over. And in the moment, we see it as this terrible thing and an indication that everything sucks now. But as time passes, you recognize that there was some good things going on there. And now, again, we revere the heavyweights of the 70s, not only as the best athletes and the best fighters, but during that period, as these great fights were always happening. But if you look back at those newspaper accounts and look back at what was being written in the magazines at the time, it was the same kind of stuff. Like I just said, George Foreman didn't defend the title. The only fight he did it was against Joe Roman, and it was in Japan. And then that whole, there was a whole weird thing that happened before the Norton fight. Foreman said he hurt his leg and he was going to pull out of the fight like the day before the fight. And it was in Venezuela because in Caracas, because he didn't want to pay taxes. There was all kinds of shady stuff going on in the 70s that we just forget about because they were the times when we were young, and you know, being young is great. So I remind myself of things like that when I get really tired of the shenanigans that we see now. You know, the 90s was a great era for heavyweights also.
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely. Some very good fighters in the 90s. A lot of guys fought each other. But I remember at the time saying, why is Lennox Lewis in court suing people and not fighting? You know? Why isn't Roy Jones fighting heavyweights if he wants to talk so much shit?
Oh, God. You know? When he beat Ruiz, and that was the 2000s, and he won the WBA title from John Ruiz, I was on my sports talk radio station, and I was considered one of the boxing experts. And the host, very nice guy, is like, well, this is a big accomplishment for Roy Jones. I'm like, he beat the fifth best heavyweight, and that's being generous when you talk about John Ruiz.
Right.
I'm like, I'm sorry. It's an accomplishment. It's just not this amazing. I'm like, he won a piece of the title. He didn't beat the man. I'm sorry.
He didn't. He beat the worst of the heavyweight titleists out there.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Right. Absolutely.
So again, whenever I get tired of all the nonsense and the bullshit, I take a step back and say, we can look back and see how it was all these times that we revere now and look back at so fondly and say every era has its shit. And this is just the way the game is. And you hang in there and hang in there and hang in there. And sooner or later, a fight comes up and you say, ah, that's what I've been. This is why I can still watch. This is why I still watch.
No, I'm with you, man. I haven't seen it yet. Have you seen the Foreman biopic?
I have not. And I don't plan to.
Really?
Yes. For a couple of reasons. Well, number one, as a Foreman fanatic, I know too much about him and his career. And I know that the movie would ruin it. It would be a terribly unpleasant experience for me to watch the movie. Because, you know, they can't just – it's a Hollywood movie, so they can't just tell the story. It's an amazing story. All they got to do is tell it exactly the way it happened, and you know that's not going to happen. They're going to – it's going to be over the top and romanticized way beyond what is necessary, right? They can't just tell the story. And so I suspected that would be the case as soon as I heard about it being made. And we have Andrew Harrison reviewing it. He went with his kids. He was going to go see the movie anyway.
Okay.
And
that's good.
His review appears in this issue. And it is essentially what I expected it to be. All right. Okay. And I don't watch boxing movies anyway. I haven't seen any of the Creed movies or any of those. I never saw the Vinny Pazienza movie or the Roberto Duran movie.
Or Southpaw with God, now I'm blanking. Not Tobey Maguire, but the actor who looks like Tobey Maguire.
I don't know.
That Southpaw movie.
I haven't seen any of those. There are two boxing movies that I watch whenever they're on. Rocky and Rocky II. And oh my God, I'm blanking on the De Niro movie.
Raging Bull, of course.
Raging Bull, of course. Right. Yeah. I'll watch those boxing movies. And I know Michael is always after me to watch the setup.
Right? Yeah, man.
Yeah. I haven't done that yet.
Great. Such a great movie. And especially, and again, being a Jersey guy and stuff, Chicago, sadly, and I'm saying this, Jake Gyllenhaal, thank you, Mike Jones, is who I was thinking of, who's the star of Southpaw. But Chicago became a tank town when Cedric Kushner, it was one of his satellite cities.
Sure.
And, you know, he would build up contenders and then put them against great fighters, and they would fold. It's just the way it was. But that's why I love the setup, because it reminded me, and no disrespect to Ernie Terrell, the great heavyweight who, in his last years, was a promoter here in Chicago and stuff. And yeah, he'd have these like tank town fights. And the setup, absolutely. And it's almost in real time.
Really?
And it's Robert Wise, the fantastic film director. So those are my votes why eventually you should see the setup.
Yeah, I got to get around to it.
Yeah, he's great at it.
I have to get around to it. But all these other boxing movies, all these other modern boxing movies, I don't watch because I know that they're just going to annoy me. I just, you know, because when you've spent your life around a sport and watching the sport and consuming it, you know what's bullshit. And you know that the storylines are going to be tired and it's going to be full of cliches. And so I don't bother with them. And I knew right off the bat that the Foreman movie would be terrible. And apparently it is.
The first time I met Foreman, he was doing an exhibition in Indiana, and I met him afterwards and stuff, and he was really nice. And you want to be a pro and you want to be a journalist and stuff, but you know, come on, you can't help it sometimes when you're a fan. I brought my copy of Fat City, the book, for him to sign. And he really lit up and he's like, I love this movie. I love this book. He goes, that's great that you brought it. I'm like, okay, that's cool. And then subsequently I would see him every now and then when he was doing color for HBO. And what I loved was, and I might've told you guys this when I had all of you on from Ringside Seat, but it was one of the Barrera Eric Morales fights.
Okay.
And he was really going on about how much he loved Eric Morales and giving a very good technical answer to why he thought Morales would win. So I turn off my recorder and I'm like, you know, I like this George Foreman that I just heard for the last 2 minutes. I'm like, why don't you do that on HBO? And he goes, they got Larry Merchant to be the expert. They got Jim to be the play-by-play guy. And I'm there to be the happy clown. That's what they paid me for.
Wow. Interesting that he would admit that. But that's absolutely perfect assessment. Yeah.
He was great. No, it was a pleasure talking to him. It really was. All right. We mentioned that obviously the review for the Foreman movie is going to be in the next issue of Ringside Seat. And we're close to wrapping up, Bill. I don't want to keep you too
long. No, I'll talk as long as you want to.
Oh, okay. I appreciate that. Tell us what else is in Ringside Seat this month.
Well, off the bat, we have our first piece by the great Hall of Fame writer, Bernard Fernandez. Bernard.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. Yeah. Bernard has joined the fold at Ringside Seat. And his first piece involves the demise of, speaking of demises, as we're talking about all the demises in boxing, the demise of prison boxing programs.
God, and you know, I'm so glad you mentioned it. I meant to mention it regarding Matthew and that era when Rahway was such a great learning place for boxing. Dwight Braxton learned in the joint and a few others as well.
Sonny Liston learned to box in prison and a prison boxing program, right? Not in Jersey, of course. But very few of those programs exist anymore. And, you know, it's not easy. It's not difficult to take that, to ask the question, where would Bernard Hopkins be if that hadn't existed where he was imprisoned?
Absolutely.
Again, Dwight Braxton, Dwight Muhammad, how we learned to box in prison. And even if guys don't come out of prisons to be world champions, it still benefits them while they're there and when they come out. Right?
It teaches them a self-discipline. Yeah.
Sure. And there are lots of job programs in prison that teach guys to be electricians or they teach them carpentry skills and this stuff. And I think the problem, believe me, I'm no expert in this area at all, but I think the problem with those types of things, these guys learn these skills and then they go back into their environment and there are no jobs for those. There's no jobs for those skills. There aren't many jobs for electricians in Camden or Detroit, maybe in the areas where these guys live. Right. So what do they have to turn back to? The life that got them into trouble to begin with. Right. But boxing, there are boxing gyms in every ghetto in the country, or there used to be. Right. So guys can learn how to fight in prison and come back and into their environments and go to a fight gym. And again, we just mentioned three guys off the top of our heads, Hopkins, Cowie, and Liston, who learned to box in prison. And there are dozens. Tune into a fight sometime and see how many guys on the undercard have served time in prison. It's the way of the world. It's the way of boxing. Right. So, and again, most of those programs don't exist anymore, which is a damn shame. And, you know, we've got so crazy in this country with incarceration that in some places, inmates aren't allowed to lift weights anymore because some idiot politician would say, has said, you know, they come out of prison all beefed up and strong, and then we can't do it, and we can't control them. What kind of idiotic bullshit is that? So that shows you the mindset that results in the prison boxing programs going away. So anyway,
that's great. And before you get to another feature, Bernie Fernandez was really kind of laid up for a while and had to have real massive back surgeries.
He did. Okay. He is doing very well. He's wonderful. Getting physical therapy and doing much better. And to kind of put it, I don't want to quote him directly because I'm going to get the quote wrong, but he feels most like himself when he's writing boxing. Okay. And he feels most alive when he's doing this stuff. So
that's great.
If I get the sense that if Bernie could only move his one little finger, his one index finger, that he would be writing boxing stories with that one index finger.
That's wonderful, man. Yeah, that's great. That's like Ebert at the end. And God, the man lost his voice. I suppose vocally he lost his voice, but not from a writing standpoint. He was stronger than ever till the end. Absolutely. And certainly we wish Bernard Fernandez many, many years. And I'm really glad. And God, when he started following me on Twitter, I'm like, oh man, we met a few times back in the 90s when I was more on the beat and stuff like that, but it really means a lot that you're following me. And he goes, hey man, we boxing guys got to stick together.
That's Bernie. Thank you, man. Yeah, that's Bernie. Yeah, he's a good guy.
And so go on. What else have you got? It's
a real honor and privilege to have him writing for Ringside Seat.
That's wonderful, man. No, one of the best.
Yeah, he really is. And our cover story is Nigel Collins, a piece that Nigel wrote in follow-up to the Tank Davis-Ryan Garcia fight. And I don't know if you heard all the hoopla before it. Some idiot came up with a slogan or a headline for ESPN.com about it being the fight to save boxing. And we get that kind of nonsense. Yeah, we get that kind of nonsense every time there's a big fight that kind of hooks in the mainstream a little bit. It's always the fight to save boxing. And so the gist of Nigel's piece is essentially that fights do not save boxing. Stars do, right? Every time there's a down cycle in boxing, and there always is, like in any sport and in anything, any commodity, there's a down cycle. There's always some star that comes along and rejuvenates the sport. And you can look back as far as you need to, from Jack Dempsey to Marciano to Ali to Leonard to De La Hoya, Tyson, Pacquiao. There's always a star that comes along to rejuvenate the sport if it's in a down cycle. Fights a fight alone doesn't do that. The stars do. And it's called the hero cycle. And that exists. And that's the subhead of Nigel's great piece, which is very well written. This is interesting. We haven't done this kind of thing before. I'm a big fan of what Showtime has been doing with their boxing. And not just because they finally got they had the big Davis Ryan Garcia fight, and apparently they participated in the making of
Spence Crawford and
Spence, right?
Yeah. Which real fast when they announced it, I'm like, I'd already given up on that. It was such an anticlimactic announcement.
Exactly right.
And it's going to happen at the end of July, and so it's not that far away. But exactly. It's like, oh, all right.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I think that was a universal response to that. But outside of those things, it seemed like just about every card they were broadcasting had some really good fights, like two or three really good fights.
Oh, yes. Yeah, the undercards. Oh, my God.
Young guys who could really fight, who were fighting good opponents and result. And that's all. And people try to make this matchmaking more difficult than it kind of is. Just put two guys in who really want to fight, have good records, and throw them in the ring together, and you're going to get good fights, right? And they've gone on a really good run of really good shows. And Stephen Espinoza, who's the head of sports there, is primarily responsible for running that ship. And I have Eric Raskin doing a full-length interview with Stephen in this upcoming issue about what they're doing right on Showtime, what they've done wrong, what they've learned along the way, what it's like to not have HBO around anymore. It's a really good interview, and Stephen is very forthcoming about something. So that's another issue. We have Do you remember the journeyman heavyweight Jeff Sims?
Yes.
So Glenn Sharp, who specializes in writing dark histories of fighters, John, it does a masterful job of revealing the sad story of Jeff Sims to our readers. A really big punching heavyweight from Florida who just couldn't get out of his own way, couldn't get out of his past in order to move himself or his career forward, even though he had lots of natural ability. So a hard-punching heavyweight from that era whose biggest moment was when he floored Ernie Shavers in their slugfest, which I believe took place on the undercard of Muhammad Ali's last fight against Trevor Burbick in the Bahamas.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's a really great and typically heartfelt piece from Glenn about the tragedy of Jeff Sims.
Interesting.
And the lightweight champion, Ken Buchanan, died in April.
Yes, wonderful fighter.
He was a wonderful fighter who should be known by American fans for more than his low blow loss to Roberto Duran.
Roberto Duran, yeah.
Bernard O'Shea does a deep dive on Buchanan and his squabbles with his manager, which I knew nothing about.
No.
And it does it in a very good way, and it's a very interesting and good read, and we'll introduce a little late, I guess, Buchanan and his history to American readers. Long after, it's long overdue, but it's a very good piece by Bernard O'Shea. And I keep looking over here because that's where it's written.
Oh, it's all good, man.
We have Ronnie McCluskey with a feature about how the things fighters do these days to stay relevant after their fighting days are over. Like we have Floyd Mayweather fighting these exhibitions against YouTubers and, you know, over in Great Britain, David Hay is on all kinds of reality shows and these type of things. It's a fun piece by McCloskey that examines that trend. Plus, we got, again, film and book reviews, as we always do. Eric Raskin has a great Southpaw Stance column on bad decisions and possible changes we can make to try to improve the decisions process in boxing. So it's a jam-packed issue.
That sounds great, man. Well, you know, my one remedy, I think, for some of these controversial decisions, we need to go to uneven rounds for a championship fight. If you want to make it 11 or 13, and obviously everyone's afraid of 13.
Right.
But
for no good reason. But
of course, for no good reason. But that's the thing, man. And I forget, I was reading someone who had realized that, you know, into the 80s, we still had 15-round championship fights. And it's like, well, that's too brutal. And it's like, it isn't.
Exactly.
I'm like, sorry, man. No, that's where your medal was proven.
It was normal. That was what we did. But
for over 100 or almost 100 years.
Exactly right.
You know.
And here's I had that same reaction, like, oh, that's so ridiculous that you think it's too brutal. That's so silly. Because it was just the fighters didn't think so. Right, the fighters were in shape. They trained for 15 rounds. They stayed active, and a lot of times, I think I responded to a tweet where I said, a lot of times at the end of 15 rounds, the good fighters were less exhausted than you see guys fighting at the end of 12 rounds now because they trained for it. It's just here again, if we step back and say, if we look back in the history books and say, oh my God, this guy knocked out this guy in the 27th round. How the hell did I do that? It was normal to them.
Yeah.
Right? It's so generational. Everything is so generational. But yeah, I had the same reaction. 15-round fights were absolutely no more brutal than 12-round fights. Absolutely not. There was a different pace and a different way of conditioning that enabled these guys to go 15 rounds. And there were no studies that proved that it was more dangerous to go 15 rounds.
Yep.
The death of Dooku Kim following the Ray Mancini, his fight with Ray Mancini was a alarmed a lot of people because it was hurt in the 13th round, I think, 13th or 14th, and got people frightened. But the main impetus was that a 12-round fight was easier to package for television shows than 15 rounds. So, but yeah, I miss 15-round fights, but it's never coming back. It just isn't.
No, it's not. You're absolutely right, man. No, nobody wants to do it, which is a shame.
It is a shame.
Yeah, and also not only the Dooku Kim death, but also, I know Tex Cobb's beating at the hands of Larry Holmes made Howard Cosell walk away from boxing decades. Yeah, those were the days.
Do you remember? Do you remember that the IBF hung in there with 15 round fights longer than the WBC and WBA did? I remember that. The only reason I remember that is because, and it was before I was writing boxing. A friend and I went to fights in Newark, New Jersey, and Bob Lee was there, and it was an IBF title fight or something. maybe it wasn't a title fight, but he was there. It was some IBF fight. And, of course, Bob Lee was a criminal and was a corrupt, terrible guy. Yeah, but the point was, when we saw it was him, we went like, yeah, 15 round fights, keep him going. And he was like, yeah, we will. And, you know, 2 months later, they were doing 12 round fights.
Sad, but true.
Yeah, but I always remember that they held on with the 15 round fights a little longer than the other guys did.
Who was your favorite color man? Who was your favorite play by play man?
You know what? Gil Clancy and Tim Ryan were so great.
They were the best team. I'll give you mine. My favorite play-by-play man, just because he had the right voice for it, was Marv Albert. My favorite man on his own, and ABC paired him with a million people, was the great Alex Waller, who really knew his shit and really just came out as just this really smart guy.
Absolutely that right.
But the best team was Ryan and Clancy.
Yeah. You know, yeah. Wallow and Dan Dierdorf were great together. I know, and I didn't. Some people dislike Dierdorf because of his football announcing, right? But I never heard him do football. I never heard of him before.
Okay, that's funny.
Before he started broadcasting the fights with Wallow, and I loved them together. And people laugh at Wallow today because wasn't he like the president? And he said, you know, president of the network, and he said, screw this, I'm just going to do the fights myself. But he was good.
He was very good. He was great. Yeah. And I mean, and you're right. And I mean, they had a revolving door for a while. I mean, they eventually settled on Dierdorf. But Lampley was there for a minute at ABC as well.
Right.
And even Keith Jackson did a couple fights with Wallow as well. But I don't know, man. Again, you're right, because I was so used to Dierdorf doing football. And poor Dierdorf, I mean, great guy. Yeah. Really, I had the pleasure of meeting him a couple times in the 90s. He had that lisp as well. And it would theme that these festivities are clearly great voice and everything. And it's like, all right, you know, I guess they had to justify the contract, so they're throwing boxing to him and stuff.
But
Ryan and Clancy were just this machine that each guy knew their role. They stayed out of the other guy's way, and it was fantastic. No, I always say, Tim Ryan was vastly underrated, but I have to admit that Marv Albert play-by-play
voice. He was great, too. You're right. He had the right voice. He really did. You know what's funny, too? And again, it shows what a hypocrite I am because I hate – one of my pet peeves, of course, as it is everybody's – this everybody that I see on Twitter, at least, is when these broadcasters announcers scream, right? I hate it. I want to mute these guys instantly when they start screaming.
Yep.
George Tessitore.
Yep.
Especially these guys screaming all the time. But you know what? When I go back and watch Dierdorf from Wallow, they screamed all the time and I love it.
I love it.
And sometimes Cosell screamed. He screamed throughout that whole fight.
But
I loved it.
Yeah, but again, I don't know. And again, maybe these are my rose-colored glasses, but it seemed like they only screamed when it was appropriate for the moment. And they didn't plan a signature knockout call or something. Right. And I'm sorry, everybody, if you love Max Kellerman, God bless you. But he annoys the hell out of me. And the one thing I'll never forget that I'm like, shut up and actually watch the fight that's unfolding in front of you. And it was one of the Canelo Triple G fights. Uh-huh. And his line was, he's winning the story. Is he winning the fight? And he kept like hammering that over and over again. And it's like, cover the fight that's in front of you.
Yeah.
And I mean, it happens in every major sport. Sure. Joe Buck does it. Joe Buck has home run calls or some sort of signature thing that he wants to put at the end. And it's like, please don't write the end. I mean, sports is that last bastion of, we don't know how it's going to end.
Right,
let it really happen in front of you and stuff. Oh, that's funny. Kerry's been watching, but he chimes in. Agree about Max Kellerman. Thank you, Kerry. I agree with you, man. There you go. So thank you, man. Yeah. I mean, again, listen, and really, I give Max a lot of credit for helping the ESPN audience digest boxing. He drives me nuts. I won't deny it. He drives me nuts.
Well, he's not. He doesn't call a fight anymore. So
No, he doesn't. But even on his Max on Boxing. Dan Rafel had a great streaming show in the early days of ESPN Plus that was a no bone show, essentially what we're doing right now. It was basically him with a camera in his office and then cutting to Zoom interviews with various people and then reading the mailbag. And I like Dan a lot. I'm sure he wouldn't remember me, but he was like a guy that when I was on the fight beat, I would talk to him, you know, and I just respect his knowledge. I think he's a very knowledgeable guy, but, man, I just that show that Max has is just, and it's so top
rank. I never watch it.
Yeah, it's so top rank oriented, and it's like, God, when the Ukraine war broke out, it kind of drove me nuts that that weekend on Showtime there was, and I forget his name, one of the welterweight contenders that was from the Ukraine was fighting the main support fight of the main event, and it's like, okay, this country's at war, and this poor guy is stuck in Vegas and has to have a 12-round fight. And I'm like, how come you're not covering this, man? I go, guess what, pal? Your heroes, Lampley and Cosell, would absolutely have this on their weekly show. And then the next week, he had this puff piece at the beginning about the spirit and the fighting spirit of the Ukrainian fighters. And it's like, no, man, give us some real journalism here. This is in fact, I had Nigel on when it was happening and stuff. And I'm like, God, Nigel, this, you know, I mean, other than things like, now I'm blanking again, middleweight and light heavyweight champion, the guy from Biafra from the 60s and 70s.
Dick Tiger.
Thank you. I'm like, I don't think we've had a situation where we've had an active fighter where his country was that much at war. Well, and of course, the explosive thin man, of course.
Nicaragua.
Alexis Arguello with Nicaragua. Yeah, man. But I'm like, this is so rare. And isn't it interesting, sadly, that while the world is on fire, these guys are in other countries. And really, God, think of all the great, like Bivol, great Russian fighters that have to fight with the stigma of what's going on with Russia and Ukraine.
Yeah. It's unfortunate.
Yeah, man. No, absolutely. Dude, as always, love talking to you.
It's my pleasure, John.
Happy to help everybody from McFarland Books, this brand new book about Matthew Saad Muhammad, Boxing's Miracle Man, with the Mike Cronenberg cover.
Yep.
And of course, semi-monthly, you get Ringside Seat. And when does the new issue come out?
I'm thinking about 3 weeks from now.
Oh, that's great, man.
Yeah, maybe a little longer, but I'm hoping for about 3 weeks from now. So before the end of June.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Always. And also, again, Cronenberg not only does great covers, but he lays out the magazine. Absolutely. As well.
Always beautiful. Always beautiful.
Man, seriously, man. And again, I'd read this stuff if it was printed on Bazooka Joe comic strip. Believe me. But that said, I mean, God, I used to get Flash Gordon's old boxing newsletter and stuff in the mail and everything.
Sure.
But no, the layout for Ringside Seat is beautiful. And it's always great to talk about this. I'll see if we got one more comment. That's nice. Mike just says, great show, gentlemen. Ah, he just bought the book from Father's
Day. Fantastic. Thanks, Mike. I appreciate that.
Outstanding, man. No. That's wonderful. Great comments from Mike and Carrie. And I hope everybody else enjoyed watching. But truly, man. All right. So we'll watch, in about a month or so or a few weeks, we'll see the next issue of Ringside Seat. But in the meantime, Boxing's Miracle Man, Matthew Saad Muhammad, available now from McFarland. Everybody should pick it up and follow Mike's steps and do that.
Thanks very much, John. I appreciate it.
As always, man, my pleasure. Everybody, thanks a lot. It's going to be a busy week on Word Balloon Live.
You got coming up?
Mark Guggenheim, the wonderful television and comic book writer, is going to be talking about his comics for Marvel and IDW. He does a Star Trek comic book that's excellent. We'll be talking about the writer's strike as well.
Ah, nice.
Wednesday, my good friend, the great cartoonist Doc Shaner, is going to join us, and that'll be a fun conversation. And then comic writer Van Jensen will be joining us as well. Nice. So,
good for you.
Busy week. Absolutely, good. Man. No. The sun never sets on Word Balloon. So
good.
Thanks a lot for watching, everybody. Hang out for 1 second, Bill, after we wrap up. But everybody watching, thank you very much. Until next time, stay safe, stay happy, stay healthy.